Hello, everyone. This is Volts for November 19th, 2025. What is the deal with indoor air quality? I'm your host, David Roberts. The modern environmental movement was practically built around the fight for clean air. However, if you look back over that history, you find that virtually all of these past battles and the subsequent laws and regulations were about outdoor air. Indoor air quality, the health effects of the air inside our buildings, has received only a tiny fraction of that attention from advocates and state officials. But indoor air quality is only going to become more important in the coming years. For one thing, climate change will drive more people indoors more often. More people will be seeking respite from wildfire smoke indoors. Climate change will accelerate the emergence of new pathogens and the spread of pandemics, and our experience with COVID suggests that our indoor air quality management falls well short of what is needed on that front. It all adds up to an urgent need for climate and public health folks to pay much more attention to indoor air quality, which may be the biggest opportunity to improve public health in the 21st century. It is obviously folly to pretend that I can cover this entire subject in the space of a single podcast, but I am going to try to hit the high points, and I've got the ideal guest. Dr. Georgia Lagoudis has a degree from MIT in biological engineering, which I didn't even know was a thing, but apparently it's useful because she has used it to advise the U.S. Senate, the Department of State, and most recently, the Biden White House on biosecurity and biosafety. She spearheaded a number of Biden initiatives, most notably, for our purposes, a White House initiative to improve indoor air quality. She is now a senior fellow at the Pandemic Center at Brown University's School of Public Health, where she is running the center's Clean Indoor Air Initiative and recently spearheaded a global pledge for healthy indoor air. I'm excited to talk with her about the current state of indoor air quality, the basic technologies that can improve it, and the kinds of policies we need in support. And yes, I will ask her about your box fans. With no further ado, Dr. Georgia Lagoudis, welcome to Volts. Thank you so much for coming.
Great to see you, David. Thanks for having me.
There's so much to talk about. You've spent your entire career studying this, and we're about to cram it into an hour, so there's so much to do. But before we really jump in, tell us a little bit about this global pledge for healthy indoor air. Like, what is that exactly, and how did that come about?
I know that you've talked about a lot of different topics on the podcast, focused on so many aspects of clean energy, and delighted to see indoor air quality as a topic you're adding in. Just briefly, I came at this topic just a few years ago, and I was like, how are people not talking about indoor air quality? And I was actually a climate nerd previous to this, so I actually used some of my bioengineering to work on biotech for improving impact on the world and sustainability, but found myself here. So excited to talk about it today. The Global Pledge, we launched a Global Pledge on Healthy Indoor Air at the United Nations in September, just a few weeks ago. And this was during the UN General Assembly. I know you and others were at New York City during Climate Week, yes. Running around the city. I was doing the same.
We were all sharing the same traffic.
I think I also went to a wrong building like you did once and had to jump on a bike. But this pledge is the first time to declare clean indoor air a fundamental human right at the highest levels. From the United Nations, from governments, France and Montenegro are two countries that signed the pledge and launched it, and from a global public health community. We had about 165 organizations sign the pledge. This has been done at a micro level and in communities to say indoor air quality matters, but this is the first time we've said something at the United Nations. We had the Undersecretary of the UN, Inger Andersen, who leads the UN Environment Program there. She spoke about this. She talked about the intersection of indoor and outdoor air. We can't ignore indoor air. And so the purpose of this pledge is to lay out the priorities for indoor air quality, why it matters to us as humans, why it matters from pandemic preparedness and climate resilience and human rights, accessibility for all, workplace safety. And then secondly, bring together a global community and a movement. And so building from this, we plan to have a multi-year effort to expand the pledge and bring this to the agenda of other international gatherings across the world.
Preaching to the choir here, but it's a little crazy when you do look into this, how little there's been, like how of all, you know, all these international declarations on anything you could imagine.
Correct.
It's a little wild that this has not come up before. I guess it's one of those kind of ideas whose time has come. Like looking into it now, I'm like, well, of course, like that's the air you spend most of your time in. So I want to start with what I think is a very basic question in all the senses of basic. I'm familiar, like I've been at this for a while, but studied outdoor air pollution a long time. I know sort of like who are the top offenders in outdoor air quality. I know like particulates are kind of, you know, the heavy hitters, there's NOx, etc. When I'm talking about indoor air pollution, is there sort of a bounded set of pollutants that I'm talking about? When I measure indoor air pollution, what exactly am I measuring for? Well, who's on our most wanted poster here?
Right. It's quite similar to outdoor air, except for, importantly, one addition that we do measure outdoors, but we don't often think about it in the context of air quality and what we're breathing. The two primary, if I start at the top of the pyramid and expand down, the two primary are particulate matter, importantly, PM2.5. We care about that outdoors. That's what comes out of wildfire smoke and car emissions, like combustion sources, industrial emissions.
And we've covered the science of that on a previous pod, so we don't have to go over it again. But to summarize, the science on particulates for the past, whatever, several decades, all point the same direction. It's worse than we thought. It's worse than that. It's worse than that. There is no safe dose. Everything we find out about it is worse than what we thought.
Yes, there is no safe dose. Recently, the EPA lowered the standards for particulate matter, and the WHO has also lowered the standards for particulate matter. Now we're close to, I think the WHO is 5 units, micrograms per cubic meter of PM2.5, which is quite low. And we're realizing that even going from 5 to 0 is strongly beneficial to your health from going from, you know, 30 to 20 or some higher levels. So particulate matter is bad. And like the science angle of that is those tiny particles enter your bloodstream. And that's where it gets scary. They cannot just impact your lung, but they go to your brain, they go to your other organs. And then the second one we importantly care about is carbon dioxide. Mm. And this is for two reasons. One is that it affects your brain. It makes us function less good. It makes us dumber when yes. CO2 is high. So I have
a very literal way.
Yeah. Like there are CEOs that say, I won't make decisions when the carbon dioxide is above 800 parts per million because I am dumber. I do not think as well. My critical thinking skills are diminished. So I have a CO2 monitor that sits on my desk and I carry this around with me and I share this to turn this invisible metric to something visible. We talk about measuring CO2 outside as we think about global warming as a metric, but we care about CO2 for two reasons. So one is our brain health. And the second is that it's a proxy for rebreathed air or other air that you share with people. So if I'm in a room with other people, CO2 will rise. And that means I'm being exposed to potentially pathogens that they have. Someone sick with COVID or sick with influenza, this is a metric to say, I should probably be filtering the air and getting some outdoor fresh air in here.
I see. It's like a proxy for how much we're sharing.
Right. Yeah. I brought this monitor with me when I testified at Rhode Island. We were supporting a bill on indoor quality in schools. And I put it on my desk when I sat kind of up there in front of the House representatives. And I watched as CO2 ticked up as people filled this kind of old classic style building in Providence, Rhode Island. And when I was speaking, when I was testifying, it had gone up to 2,000 parts per million. Not great ventilation in that building. And so I told the representatives.
We're all dumber, right?
We're all dumber. Also, 2,000 parts per million means that for every breath you take, 4% of it is someone else's breath.
Wild.
So you are breathing in. We're sharing this air. And so all of them looked at me with raised eyebrows and were suddenly scared.
What a disturbing research project it would be to go to House legislatures across the country and measure the CO2. It might explain a lot. So I think it's rare outside for CO2 to reach concentrations where they have this sort of direct health effect. Obviously, you know, it's climate we're worried about when it's outside. So why does CO2 gather, concentrate inside? Is it just poor ventilation and rebreathing? Is that the whole story?
Right. There are some similarities with particulate matter, but slightly different ways that you can reduce the pollutant. Mm-hmm. So CO2, the problem is that we can't capture it through filters. So particulate matter, we can filter the air. There's three main ways of cleaning the air. You filter it, you run it through tiny pore sizes. Number two, you ventilate, which means you bring outdoor air in and exchange air. And three is you can disinfect the air. This is through some technologies called UV, where you basically shine light and you zap it. This is right. Common practice for decades in hospital settings, in some hospitals where you'll have like upper room UV, shines a light, kind of zaps the pathogens, kills them. Less common in public, non-healthcare settings. But those are the three tools we have. Filters are by far the easiest and cheapest because you don't have to worry about heating and cooling the air or addressing humidity and so forth.
So just so we're clear, we're worried about particulates. We're worried about CO2. Those are the two big ones. There's also a couple of strays, aren't there? There's a couple of other...
Yeah. There's a few others. So kind of then we descend. I mentioned those as kind of the two easiest in that they are... We have low-cost, accurate monitors we can use to measure them, and they give us a really good proxy for most changes we want to make in a building for ventilation and filtration. Then we kind of go to a second tier of additional ones that are good and important to measure. There we have kind of a category of compounds called volatile organic compounds. These are things like benzene and formaldehyde and kind of scary-sounding names. A lot of this comes from paints and carpets and furniture.
Cooking? Am I making that up?
Some cooking, yeah, like combustion sources of cooking. Like if you have gas stove, there you add, like you can have benzene. There you also add nitrogen dioxide and some additional compounds that come off that. So nitrogen dioxide is an important one. We also have carbon monoxide. Many of the buildings we live in already have monitors because carbon monoxide is so dangerous to health. Those are a category of compounds you can measure. So volatile organic compounds and other gases in the air. We talked about particulate matter. There's other forms of particulate matter 10, larger particle sizes. And then you also go to a category of biological compounds, I'll call them biological pollutants. These are things like allergens or mold or bacteria or viruses. And those are harder to measure in the air, but this is kind of a newer area of research is how do we actually have sensors that can detect those in real time.
Interesting. Okay, so those are our enemies indoors. Let's talk briefly technology. I'm going to take technology from two sides. One, the latter is probably more important, but the first is exciting to me as a geek, which is if I were building a new building, say, I don't know, a 10-story, whatever, apartment building, what does state-of-the-art new, like cutting edge, like what is, in terms of indoor air quality, what am I doing to a brand new building if money's no object? What is the best out there?
Right. If money is no object and you want the best building, number one, you want high levels of ventilation. And so you're going to pick the highest standards that there exist around the amount of fresh air per person or equivalent clean air is a term used in the field, which is how much of people that are in the building, I'm making sure that each of them gets this amount of fresh air. We also have demand control ventilation. So we don't ventilate the building when it's midnight and no one's in the building, but we're doing it efficiently so that when people are there, also with demand control ventilation, you have sensors in a building. So you have sensors that measure CO2 and measure particulate matter. But importantly, if they measure CO2, they know when you have a lot of people in the building. And so the highest end buildings will adjust to keep CO2 below a certain threshold.
I see. So sort of variable ventilation that will sense how much is needed at the moment.
Right. So you're ventilating at a high standard at a baseline. Number two, you're adjusting based off of people and the conditions, whether it's wildfire smoke outside or people inside, you're maintaining something. And then you have some opportunity for further adjustments to say, oh, it's flu season and we want to crank up the ventilation. We can do that. Or we want to focus it in on this auditorium where lots of people are coming. So you have some ability to adjust in the building. And you're doing all of this in an energy efficient way, which means you're using things like energy recovery ventilators and heat pumps to make sure you're doing it at the lowest possible cost for energy and efficiency.
And the heat exchanger is you just pull the heat out of the air before you vent it back outside, basically, so you don't lose
exactly.
So you don't lose heat. So one of my big questions here is this just ventilation, the best you're going to get there is equalizing indoor and outdoor air quality, right? So there's got to be some filtering, right? There's got to be some cleaning of the air if you want your air to be, like if there's fire smoke outside and you want your air and sort of cleaner than outside, you need more than just ventilation, right? So what is the filtering stage?
Right. So you need both ventilation and filtration. If we have people inside and we want to keep things like CO2 at a lower level, you also need to be able to ventilate and filtrate. If I'm living in a polluted city and I open my window, I'm going to get whatever the particulate matter is out there inside my building. And so you need to bring in air, run it through a filter, do that in an energy efficient way, and then recirculate it back outside. So you're doing essentially both at the same time.
Your ventilator intake has a filter in it.
Yes. And so this is what heat recovery ventilators or energy recovery ventilators have, which is the unique and special thing about something that's different from like a heat pump, which can provide heat, or sometimes people will have mini splits or AC units that are sitting up and they're circulating the air in the room and they're heating or cooling it, but they're not exchanging air from the outside. And so the really unique and efficient thing that energy recovery ventilators do is they bring in outdoor air. They do this heat transfer, so you're really efficiently heating or cooling the air. You're filtering it, bringing it inside, and then you put it back outside. And you create this loop that does both, ventilate and filtrate.
So your ventilation and your filtration and your heating, really, some of your heating are all kind of in one big step. Is there anything to say about filters? I mean, is there any sort of like, is the technology of filters particularly interesting, or has it advanced much in recent years, or do we more or less know what we need to know about how to filter air?
We've known this for almost a century, basically World War II technology, as we figured out how to make filters. They're mesh fibers. You can add an electrostatic charge to capture particles more efficiently. But we've known how it works. We just haven't fully implemented. The story I'll give is that there's different ratings for filters. So we often hear HEPA, which is a form of really high capture efficiency of particles. There's also a different rating that's lower than HEPA, which is a MERV rating of capturing different particle sizes. Buildings commonly use MERV 8, which is one category of filters. Recommended by the CDC and other standard body is closer to MERV 13. The difference is that MERV 13 captures 77% of virus particles. MERV 8 captures little to none, around 10%, depending exactly on the
function. So there's a threshold, distinct threshold there.
Right. And so we've often thought about filters. I mean, this came to light during the COVID pandemic. We often thought of filters as, okay, capture the big chunks, and that sounds good. But we hadn't thought about health-based air standards, that air should be healthy, not just from particulate matter, but from disease. Like, we shouldn't get sick from the air. This was a new paradigm.
You would think.
And during COVID, right, we were like, oh, wait, how do we make the indoors more like the outdoors?
And that's just a tighter version of the same filter?
It's just a tighter
better
mesh.
Version of the same?
Yeah.
Interesting. And mesh doesn't sound particularly expensive to me. Like, it doesn't sound like this is a particular cost center. Like, you can get good filters relatively cheap.
You can even build your own air purifier.
Yes, we've got a lot of questions about that. Believe me, I threw this out on Blue Sky and turns out there's a whole robust community of people obsessed with building their own air filters. Well, that's a state-of-the-art big building. If I'm just building a residential home, is it the same thing? It's air intake and like ventilation, filtration, heat exchange, same basic thing?
Yeah, I think you have all the same basics. You want to ventilate and do filtration. Ideally, you do that with something like an energy recovery ventilator so that you can be doing both at once.
That's pretty expensive, though, at the residential level, isn't it?
Right. So I was going to say, there's an upfront higher cost. And you might say, well, I just want a heating source. You can do what I'm doing in my apartment, which is I crack the windows and I run air purifiers to essentially enhance bringing in some outdoor fresh air. But the problem is if you seal up your home and you're not having a way to bring some outdoor air in, you're just accumulating all of those indoor pollutants and CO2 and all the people you have over from your dinner party. So different options for folks at home. I think having a well-functioning HVAC system is really important because it basically allows you to set and forget. You know, you replace your filters and you run it and you have a technician maybe check it once a year, have those high quality filters. And then ideally, if you have the means to, is have something like an energy recovery ventilator to allow you to efficiently heat and cool air, but also filter it.
Got it. Problem is, most people out there are in buildings that are already built, and we would like to make those safer. Is that a substantially different undertaking than building a new system? Like, what do you do with, you know, let's say a 10-story apartment building that's got whatever was off the shelf in the 1990s? You know what I mean? Like, how difficult is retrofitting this stuff to bring it up to decent standard?
You said a key word there, which is retrofitting. So there's a few things you can do in existing buildings. Number one, it's a really important question because the majority of the building stock is existing buildings. Also, we have challenges like close to 50% or so of schools may not be mechanically ventilated. So a lot of schools don't have HVAC systems that aren't centrally controlled mechanical ventilation systems. So that just adds another layer of saying, these are really important places where, you know, kids learn and work for 8 hours a day, and we're dealing with many buildings that don't have mechanical ventilation. I think the first and most important thing to do is a commissioning of the building system. If it has mechanical ventilation, is you get an engineer to come and check your system. I've heard way too many stories of no one having looked under the hood of the ventilation system of a building and finding, number one, terrible things in there like old animals' nests or mold or other bad stories. And then number two, just like you tune up your car, you need to do some adjustments and maintenance of this equipment, which is your mechanical ventilation. So commission your building is a recommendation that I give and many others in this field. Check that. And often by doing, this is like a tune-up, by doing a tune-up of your building, you can save energy costs too because you're fixing some issues that arise. Number two is assess where you have poor ventilation or filtration or where you need to make changes and do the best that you can with either resources or equipment. So it might be that, like, we've engaged with the Boston Public School District, I think it's 70% of the buildings are not mechanically ventilated. They deployed indoor air quality monitors in every classroom across the school district. This is the oldest school district in the United States. Mm. So number one, they just put monitors in to measure what's there. They're measuring CO2, particulate matter.
And that's cheap too, right? These monitors are like, these are cheap devices.
Yeah, this is you can buy monitors order of 100, 200 bucks. You can go up for a little bit more fancy components, but you can buy them at a pretty reasonable price now. So they deployed those in all the classrooms to see what's going on. And then number two is they made adjustments that could include a number of things. One was they made sure windows are working. So they updated windows, right? Like, make sure in your home if you have functioning windows. Number two, they put in air purifiers in a large fraction of classrooms. So they didn't have this mechanical system to run it through the HVAC system. They put in these local air purifiers. They bought it to the size of the room. So you can do the same thing in your home, in your bedroom, in your kitchen. And then number three, I think they made other adjustments where appropriate. So maybe they bought, you know, updated window units that might have filters as well, or what kind of heating they have to make sure that that's appropriate for the room. I'll give you a very different example, which is I'm currently working with a country of Montenegro on how they can advance indoor air quality and bring healthy air to all of their schools in the country. So Montenegro was one of the countries that was at the United Nations event. And they have a really different problem because a large portion of their rural schools have wood-burning stoves in every classroom.
Oh, yeah. We should just say, like, that in terms of indoor air quality outside of the developed countries, that is the big thing.
Yeah. So there you need to replace, you need to upgrade that wood-burning stove to some clean form of heating source for those kids, and do so in a way that you're also making sure the air is clean and safe. So, you know, we're working on a very different set of recommendations for those entities from the kind of classic home in the United States.
I mostly want to keep this constructive and forward-looking, but you've touched on something that has always bugged me. So I'm going to ask you about it because you seem really well-placed to have some insights on this. But I thought that COVID made several lessons very obvious, and that we would all learn them. And I turned out to be very wrong about that. A lot of people did not find those lessons obvious, and we did not learn them. But I thought, like, if nothing else, really, if nothing else, surely we've learned that it's not good that a bunch of kids are in schools that are actively making them sicker. Surely, if nothing else comes out of COVID, we will come out of this with a commitment to indoor air quality in our schools. Surely that can't be partisan. That can't be controversial. And then, like, tell me if I'm wrong about this, but my sense is it did not galvanize anything. There was no big burst of action. Like, we're not much better off now than we were then. Like, if nothing else, why didn't we come out of COVID at least committed to better air quality in schools? Because, like, we don't have to cover all the reasons, but, like, they learn better. Their brains are literally forming. Like, their personalities are literally forming. Like, these are lifelong effects with tiny, cheap interventions. Like, there's just no, you can't find a public policy intervention where you get more bang for your buck than not poisoning children's brains. So I don't want to just bang on the table, but, like, why did we come out of that whole experience with, like, no tailwinds at all? Like, nothing happened. What happened?
Great question. And I will take a sigh with you, David, because I feel the same amount of exasperation. And that is why I'm working on this topic now. In some ways, when I was at the White House and thought about this, I was like, surely there's an organization, there's a group, they're working on this, they're figuring it out. How do I call them and support them and say, great, keep going, guys. And there wasn't. And I think the number one issue is that indoor air quality falls between the cracks of many disciplines and many decision makers. One example is I went around the federal government. So I was serving as a senior advisor in the White House during the Biden administration and during the COVID pandemic. And I said, let's see who's in charge in the federal government. Who should I call and say, hey guys, air quality is important. How do we help you talk more about it? And I called the CDC, and the CDC is like, yeah, right. Okay. We do public health, but this is kind of more of an environmental topic. Talk to the EPA.
EPA, OSHA.
EPA is like,
throw a dart.
Not quite us. The National Institutes of Health. Call NIH. Yeah. So call NIH and kind of, oh, this is more of applied, not basic research. Call someone else. And so there was a pass the buck because it falls peripherally in many people's mission and purview, but it is not central to one. It is a public health issue. Is it an environmental issue? It is a workplace safety issue.
Right.
It is a biosecurity issue. Is it a defense issue? All of these components.
It is all of those.
And so there wasn't someone in charge, David. And to me, that was the most frustrating. I think that is one component. I think the second is that we didn't, I mean, COVID was a chaotic time, but we didn't have clear playbooks or targets of what exactly to do. We were like, quickly throw a Band-Aid on the problem, buy a lot of air purifiers.
Yeah.
And so the market was flooded with a lot of companies, some good, some less good, selling all sorts of things. And then you asked a teacher to plug in the air purifier in the corner and remember to turn it on or off every day. And if the janitor unplugs it, to remember to plug it back in. That doesn't work. That's not system level durable change. So we didn't have that in place. And I think the third thing is that we weren't aligned around what metrics to ask for and to demand for. Like, I carry around the CO2 monitor because it allows me to turn this invisible thing into a visible thing. So I can walk into a public space and say, the CO2 is above 2000 here. That's unacceptable. That is unsafe. That means there's a lot of shared air. We're not doing enough that we can for our brain and our respiratory disease. So I think we didn't have this concept of demand. And if we did, I think what happened was that as the COVID pandemic continued and the politicization, it was then less acceptable to want to ask for this, you know, demand clean air as a right due to COVID. And so there's been a lot of shift in the dialogue right now to talk about outdoor smoke and exposure to outdoor smoke. How do we reduce asthma and allergies? And that's okay. I think that's great. There's many benefits. And I actually think this aligns really well with the Make America Healthy Again movement. This is actually a great opportunity. And I think if there are some, you know, champions there that they care a lot about clean environment and what their children are exposed to.
They say they do.
So I think everyone can win. And we're still working on how to gain traction so that we can all figure this out together.
Yeah, yeah. As you say, it's very diffuse, and just like the administration of schools in the U.S. is local. You know what I mean? There's not a lot of central levers you can pull that affect all schools. So,
I mean, I went down this rabbit hole. I mean, very effective rabbit hole, but learning about how is our building air quality maintained, and it goes down to this technical and kind of nerdy, but really important society, the American ASHRAE, the American Society for Heating, Refrigeration, and Air Conditioning Engineers. They're the ones that write building codes that are adopted across the world, not just the United States. But the problem is that all of these are adopted at the state and city level.
Let's pivot then to policy. This is a good segue. So, you know, we, as you say, like there's several problems, bunch of different solutions, bunch of different sort of organizations involved, pretty diffuse. So if you're advocating for policy at the state level, I am, for the time being, just ignoring the federal government. If you're looking at state level, if I'm a state lawmaker, I listen to this pod, I'm like, oh my, this is important. Nobody's paying attention to this. I should do something. What is it I'm doing? If I have like a top three priority list, I know you recently worked on and got a bill passed in Rhode Island. So you use that as an example, but like, what is good state policy here?
Right. Yeah, I advised a bill, and we actually didn't fully get it passed. It came out of the Senate, not the House. And so we're going to work on it for one more legislative cycle. It's hard to get a bill passed in one session, as you probably well yeah. know. So it takes a little groundwork.
Although I also do wonder, like, who is the other lobby? Like, who's the who's fighting this?
Who's the enemy or
who's the enemy
back?
Of indoor air quality? Like,
the only pushback we had was that this costs money and how are we going to pay for it?
Of course.
So it's mostly a money concern. What we did in Rhode Island was we said, number one, the main outline of that bill and my number one recommendation to lawmakers is look at it in your schools and the place where you have your most vulnerable population and make sure the air quality is good. And we advised some of the leaders in Rhode Island to come up with a bill for what works for the state of Rhode Island. And in this case, it was, number one, put some guidelines out. So the Rhode Island Department of Health to publish numbers. What should we aim for? What is good and bad for indoor air quality? There's different ways to go about that, but basically CO2, particulate matter. Number two, check the ventilation in your school buildings every so often. In Rhode Island, we said, do it as a part of the every 5-year school building infrastructure assessment. Every 5 years is not that frequently, but it is a place to start because many schools, the only time you have to check ventilation of your building is when it's built. That's what the standards are built for, is they say when you build a building, this is what's required to happen. But most states and cities adopt the building codes and they basically leave out the operation and maintenance part. So there's no requirement years later to check your ventilation. So number two, like check the ventilation of your buildings. And then number three was upgrade the quality of the filters. So go up to the MERV 13 that captures the biological contaminants, viruses, bacteria in the air. So that would be my kind of like first top line recommendation to a lawmaker.
Yeah. I do worry about this just translating into more requirements and obligations on already beleaguered school administrators. You know, you'd also like to give them some help.
Right.
You know, I don't know what that would look like exactly.
Yeah, and different states have passed funding packages. So Connecticut passed some funding to support, actually a part of it was a really cool component, which was in partnership with the University of Connecticut, do kind of a statewide school education and air purifier building campaign, like teach students how to measure air quality, how to take action in their own hands, but also fund schools to be able to do upgrades.
This does seem like something that like kids could do, like measuring CO2 in a room is, you know, pretty straightforward. Like if you can get them excited about it, it seems like you could like distribute a lot of this.
Yeah. One of my colleagues has actually made a little Game Boy air quality monitor. So it's like a Tamagotchi for air quality. So you need to keep your pet happy and healthy. And you do that with air quality. It's been cool to see it distributed and people get excited to say, oh, now this is a thing I can interact with and understand.
Hey there, everybody. Don't worry, I'm not going to tell you about a new mattress or push a credit card on you. This isn't an ad. There are no ads on Volts. It is supported entirely by listeners like you. If you'll indulge me for a second, I'd like to ask for your support. I started Volts because we're all surrounded by depressing news about climate change and misinformation about clean energy, and it's never been more important to share the stories of the real people on the ground doing the real work of transition. And all the ingenuity and courage and public spirit they are bringing to it. People are hungry to hear these stories, to learn from and find inspiration in them. I've heard from people who change majors or careers after hearing episodes of Volts, people using it in classrooms and community groups, even state legislators who have passed bills inspired by specific episodes. Sharing these stories matters. It makes a difference. If you have found value in it and want to help me continue doing it, I hope you will join the community of paid subscribers at volts.wtf. It's about the cost of a cup of coffee a month. If you don't like subscriptions, you can make a one-time contribution, leave a review on Apple or Spotify, or just tell a friend about Volts. I am grateful for any and all support. If you're already a paid subscriber, thank you. And now, back to the show.
One of my colleagues has actually made a little Game Boy air quality monitor. So it's like a Tamagotchi for air quality. So you need to keep your pet happy and healthy, and you do that with air quality. It's been cool to see it distributed, and people get excited to say, oh, now this is a thing I can interact with and understand. So I think there's opportunity to get kids involved. And then I think the thing I'll say, David, like you're like, oh, this is hard and it costs money and it's going to have more requirements for teachers or school leaders. And it is unacceptable to have poor indoor air quality. What you said, it is unacceptable that we're exposing children to potential long-term health effects. And we haven't as a society arrived there. And I hope we are. That is my hope and goal of how this work can move forward, is that we should say it can cost money, but we're going to decide that the health benefits outweigh the costs.
I mean, that's what we did with outdoor air very explicitly in the 70s. Like the Clean Air Act basically says, make the air clean. It doesn't say anything about how much it costs. It just says, like, here are the standards, meet them. Like, but we just never did that with indoor air.
Yeah. We haven't arrived at it to say, it is something I deserve. I should have indoor air quality. It's unfair if I don't have indoor air quality. And I think we are still in this education component that we need to recognize what to ask for and what is good or bad. But just like you said, it was kind of a no-brainer that we arrived at this for outdoor air. That, yeah, I see it. I see the smog over LA. That looks gross. I don't want to breathe that. Or I smell the fumes from this car. And indoor air pollution is a little trickier because we don't have plumes of smoke usually indoors. And the compounds are less smelly. So we don't have as much of these visible, tangible aspects to trigger us to say, oh, this is unfair that I'm being exposed to this.
Again, preaching to the choir, but like, I don't know how much time you spent digging into education policy, but it is a vortex of madness. Nothing works. No one knows anything. Everyone hates everybody else, but like no one can figure out a truly efficacious educational intervention. Like they all fall apart at scale. This is kind of the thing about education, is nobody really knows what to do. And here is like measurable, testable, absolutely like predictable improvements in student performance. Like if you want improvements in student performance, it's very difficult to figure out how to get them. But here's one thing that absolutely works. Yeah. Literally, don't poison them.
We don't have the leaders championing this and people holding the microphone and bringing this to student leaders. We don't. There are not, you know, a set of organizations dedicated to this for whatever reason, right? I think it has been past public health campaigns have been triggered by something. Ideally, in some ways, COVID could have triggered that for indoor quality.
We
don't have someone selling the principle to say students will have a 13% reduction in absenteeism. They're going to show up more. Your school's actually going to get more dollars for the federal government in some states because the students are showing up. It's actually a payback. Number two, student test scores will increase 10%, order of 10%. Like all these things, we haven't created both the educational pitch and the economic pitch to education leaders. And the hard part is you have to do that to everyone. Right? There's not this centralized role.
Yeah, it's sort of something I've learned over and over again over the past several decades, is it doesn't matter how obvious something is. If it's just sitting there being obvious, like somebody's got to go yell the obvious thing.
You right.
know, somebody's got to go say the obvious thing loudly and repeatedly, even if it is obvious.
Yeah.
What about at the city level? I think like probably the state is the best ideal sort of locus here for policy, but are there things cities specifically could do? You mentioned Boston. Like I guess any city could pass out sensors. Are there particular other things cities can do?
Yeah. Cities could have sensor deployment monitoring programs, whether you go rent them or you give them out to households or other schools.
Don't you have to have a carbon monoxide sensor by law in buildings? Couldn't we just add CO2 to, you know, I don't know what a carbon monoxide sensor really is, but like how hard would it be to also sense CO2 or just require CO2 sensors in addition?
Absolutely. We could do it. You can write it into law and make it exist, David. It can happen. The question is what you do with that. So why should we pay for it? And then if you have a CO2 monitor in, and many newer buildings have this, many rooms now have CO2 monitors in the ducts and in the little temperature monitoring device buildings. It's not uncommon for many buildings to already have CO2 baked in, but we don't have requirements for it. So yes, I agree. There could be requirements just to measure. So Belgium in 2022 passed a law that said all public spaces of the country must have a CO2 monitor and be transparent, visibly present this to people coming in. And they're going to phase this
in. Yeah, if you want to induce building owners to make these investments, that's one way is like, if everyone who walks in can see exactly what your indoor air quality is.
Right, and in some ways you can say, we won't, like Belgium right now is not having mandatory requirements. It's just saying, make it visible.
Yeah, yeah.
So suddenly if you can put on the wall these numbers, just like, you know, restaurant food safety ratings, you get an A or a B minus, you're like, I'm not sure about that C food safety rating if I want to eat there.
Or if you're choosing a school, like, sorry, this...
Yeah, yeah.
The school will make my kid dumber. It says so right there on the wall.
Right. And I think this goes back to this earlier point of you can be empowered and you can empower those around you with air quality monitors, these low cost, decently accurate ones, but just measuring your spaces. But to answer your question, David, of like what policies, I just want to put a few on the table for city lawmakers and state lawmakers to think about. Like one is about schools, whether it's supporting school ventilation assessments or building commissioning or programs where you deploy monitors, deploy air purifiers. I think a second, especially at the city level, is building code councils.
My third question about policy was about codes. It's unclear to me exactly who's in charge of those. And if you wanted to intervene in that process, what do you do? How do we start changing these codes?
Right. It is a harder to crack box. I think that it becomes technical and kind of a little more siloed. But number one, at the city or state level, you can require certain building codes. And so many states will require that in law. California has certain state building codes. There's a commonly used building code that is common for many school districts across the nation.
But am I right in saying, and maybe I learned this from you and I'm just preaching it back to you, but like current building standards typically have requirements about the temperature and comfort of indoor air, but they just don't have anything about the health.
Right, right.
I mean, is that a fair generalization?
So maybe just to close out policy actions, and then let's dive into building codes, because I think there's a lot to unpack there, is like adjust the building codes to the latest and do a full adoption of them. So adopt all of it, not just those first building requirements. I think a third really important thing is this thing we said at the beginning of why was this a missed opportunity during COVID? My first answer to you was there was no one in charge. It falls between the cracks. At the state and city level, absolutely. Pick someone. Just pick someone, make them in charge and make them run an interagency task force, whatever that is, so you can have all the people at the table, but have someone have the decision-making power. So yeah, those are a few recommendations. And we published a state guide for indoor quality with 24 organizations 2 months ago from Brown University and try to outline actions for state governors as well as school leaders and other settings.
So there's kind of a template now. If you're a state or city leader, you can go consult this.
Yes. And there's a whole team of organizations standing at the ready to help you. So if you at the city or state level want to take action, we can help you find people, you know, technical experts that will help you actually do that implementation or guide the steps. So now maybe diving into building codes, because that is kind of its whole other section. You called out importantly that the way we typically use building codes in the United States is that they're about when a building is first built. So ASHRAE, this association I mentioned that writes building ventilation codes, if you go look at the building code, 62.1 is for most commercial buildings for ventilation standards. That code has operation and maintenance in it. It says every month, every year, you need to do these things. But most cities and states just adopt a portion of that building code. So one thing policymakers could do is say we should adopt all of it. recognizing that there may be pushback, because then suddenly building owners have to pay for annual maintenance of the air quality in their buildings.
Then you'll get a counter lobby once you start making people do things.
But the other piece, David, with these building codes is that at a first pass, great, let's adopt the existing building codes we have. Let's set a minimum floor.
Yeah, yeah.
But the problem, there's a major problem, and we're not going to fix these all at once. I think we need like a multi-year approach. The problem with this building code, the commonly used building code, is that it is not health-based. We do not have a health-based indoor quality standard in the United States. The way that our building code for ventilation is written right now is it is set at a level of ventilation whereupon 80% of building occupants do not complain about odor. It is an odor-based...
That's the literal metric?
Yes. Yes.
You take a survey. Does anything stink?
Exactly. They took a survey of building occupants and they said 80% didn't complain about the smell. And we're going to set this level of liters per second per person of clean air. And the level that they put it at has changed over time. So it actually used to be double. Pre-1970s, we had order of 30 cubic feet per minute per person that would come in for clean air. And then in the 1970s, we had the energy crisis.
Oh.
And there was an update to say, how do we make buildings more efficient? Do we really need this level of ventilation? Is that important?
Right.
And so they cut it by half. They cut the ventilation by half, hitting this metric of 80% don't find it smelly. So we just lost this concept of health-based standard. And then that led us to the decade of the 80s, which is when we had this proliferation of sick building syndrome, which is when you had all these perfectly sealed office buildings with low ventilation, and everyone was getting headaches and feeling dizzy and having a cough. And then we realized the buildings were making people sick because they were so sealed.
This was always sort of one of these lingering worries out on the edges, like, what if you do too much? That's not anybody's fault, really. It's just that we did not integrate health into the standards that these people were following.
Yeah. And I think we had more of a consensus earlier on, a century ago, around the importance of health in our indoor environment. And we lost that, I think, because of a prioritization of energy efficiency. And so what we've done is we've played this dangerous game of improving energy efficiency at the cost of human health. And we haven't figured out how to balance both.
Are they always at odds? I mean, it is a real trade-off. Like, if you are circulating more air, you are using more energy. It's not, the trade-off itself is not an illusion.
It's not an illusion. And you can absolutely do both. Mm. You can absolutely have an energy efficient building and a healthy building. The amount of cost of energy is pennies. Just increasingly is just incremental on the total energy cost. Joe Allen is a professor from Harvard that I've collaborated with. He works in the space. He's done some analyses of these types and found that you can spend order of $40 per employee per year of increased ventilation costs. And that will give you $7,000 of gained employee productivity per person. Almost a 200-to-1 gain.
Amazing.
And this is because you're spending so much more on your individual employee in terms of dollars than you are on your energy cost of your building. So it's an economic no-brainer for businesses. And we have to be okay with a little bit increased energy if that's, you know, for wanting to crank up ventilation a little bit.
And especially also if the whole business class has decided that their employees need to come back to work, you know, maybe they could do their part of the bargain and make the buildings healthy at least.
Yeah, exactly. I think we haven't recognized how much of an impact the air quality has on our health. One of the first examples I'm seeing now of entities and policy bodies recognizing that we have to do both is actually in the European Union. So the EU has the Energy Performance of Buildings Directive that has existed for many years that says something about, here's a directive to all member states around what energy metrics you have to meet and how you do transparency. And late last year, they had a recast or kind of an update to it. And for the first time ever, they included indoor air quality. So they said, you must have a minimum bar of indoor air quality. You must set some minimum standards. So it's the first time I'm seeing really at a large scale that we have to address energy efficiency, but it can't be at the cost of human health.
So cities and states can just adopt the whole energy code rather than the first half. That's one thing. But do the building codes themselves need rewriting? And what does that look like? Is this ASHRAE, you know, meet in a isolated building somewhere and release white smoke when the when the new codes are ready? How does all that work?
Right, right. We can use the existing standards we have and more fully adopt them, like you said. We also have newer standards that we could adopt. And so one that was recently developed 2 years ago, and this was out a result of my White House work, was ASHRAE 241 is the name of the standard, and standard for infectious disease control. And it's basically the first of its kind that is a health-based ventilation standard. So cities and states could adopt this newer standard. It basically raises the floor to say, we're not just setting this based off of odor, we're setting on making sure people don't get sick. Like, how do we maximize it? And typically, ASHRAE takes about 5 years to develop a new standard. It's a slow-moving body. It's made of volunteers. It's a consensus-based process. But when I was at the White House, I was working with Dr. Ashish Shah, who was the COVID response coordinator at the time for President Biden. And Ashish and I were on the same page that indoor air quality is a no-brainer. How do we move the needle on this? And we both talked about this and found that ASHRAE developing a new standard could change the field of having some new health-based standard to aim for. And so we had a call with them and they developed a new standard in 6 months. So during the pandemic, they could do it. They can do it. And so they brought together not only ventilation engineers, but public health experts. It's not a usual part of their process.
Interesting. Well, that's really cool. It seems like progress. I have mostly focused on the U.S. here. But I'm just sort of curious, this general state of things where this has kind of fallen through the cracks, not getting as much attention as outdoor air, not getting as much attention as other climate stuff, sort of nobody's in charge. Is that replicated in other countries? Is that a standard? Is that the typical state of affairs? Or are other countries doing it better? And particularly, I'm wondering, in the sort of emerging economies, because there's a lot of talk about leapfrogging. You know, I'm sure you've heard all the talk about leapfrogging. They leapfrogged landlines to cell phones. And in energy, we're all sort of hoping they leapfrog over fossil fuels to clean energy. Could they leapfrog to clean buildings? Is this taking off internationally? Can you generalize about the state of play internationally?
Yes, the state of play is slowly moving. I think we are at a tipping point where we are trying to hit some exponential growth. And that, I think, was what happened at the United Nations. We had 350 people show up from around the world for this event, and we had 165 organizations sign this pledge in two countries. And I think this, we brought together in some ways, for the first time, I haven't seen everyone sit around the table. That's from the climate sector, plus the biosecurity sector, plus the public health sector. And by doing that, David, we're trying to create this, in some ways, fear of missing out. Like, how can you make change, have others see it, and then catalyze action? And so France and Montenegro trumpeted what they're doing, and kudos to both of them. So Montenegro is launching this nationwide effort for clean indoor air in schools. Part of that will be setting standards. I'm helping them develop a kind of a policy agenda for how do they integrate this in the government. We're facing these similar questions of, does the Ministry of Environment or the Ministry of Health or the Ministry of Education hold the deciding power on any of these? I'll just make a note to say that's happening in Montenegro partly because of a wealthy individual, Vitalik Buterin, that has decided this is a really important topic. And also, like you and I and all the other Air Club members, saying that it's a no-brainer. Why aren't people taking action? And so Vitalik is working with the support of Montenegro government to advance this. But what other nations are doing is there's basically a few cherry-picked examples. So Belgium, I already mentioned, they're coming at this from workplace safety and individual rights. There's been action from France and advancing schools and nursing homes. There are other entities not in Europe. So I'll think about Singapore and South Korea are two examples. So South Korea actually has one of the few indoor air quality control acts.
Oh, interesting.
Which is one of the first to actually talk about indoor quality specifically. And they have these transparency requirements about indoor air quality. And the United Arab Emirates is another entity that said, wow, it's really hot outside. And it's also polluted outside, and it's only going to get worse because of climate change. How do we make sure the space that people inhabit most of the time is clean and safe? And so they've required ASHRAE 241, this really high standard for health-based ventilation, in all of their buildings in the country. So for UAE, it's all government buildings. Dubai has said for all new buildings.
It's just something that's just sort of occurred to me. Like a lot of what's going to be happening in these countries that are getting hotter is just a lot more air conditioning. This is something everybody in energy world is panicked about. You know, we really need to do this well. Are there sort of like cheap AC units with filters built in? Like, can you integrate air quality and air conditioning in a cheap way in the emerging world?
Sigh. I haven't seen much of this. And it's wild. There's been a huge effort in India to advance low cost and efficient air conditioning units.
Yeah, right.
And most of those do not have filters, especially in India, where there are so many, right? There's places with so much pollution.
It seems like it would be easy.
It seems obvious, David. It seems simple. We're, you know, remarkably. And I think that is the theme of this conversation, that we haven't recognized how much of a no-brainer indoor quality is. It's low cost. The interventions are low cost. It's passive. It just sits in the background and does work for you. And the health impacts are so...
And the benefits are compounding. I keep beating this over and over again, but like you improve a kid's brain, literally his brain, that like it improves his entire future life. Like you cannot find public policy interventions that pay back more over extended periods of time.
Yeah. The other thing that I'll just say to tie a thread together is we arrived at this for outdoor air. We arrived at this kind of common thread that outdoor air is a human right. The right to a clean environment is a human right. And we haven't arrived at this for indoor air quality. And we haven't arrived that it is unfair if I'm exposed to it. We spend 90% of our time indoors. And often indoors is 2 to 5 times more polluted than outdoors.
That's crazy.
Which, yeah, I think we just haven't been able to get this into the mainstream to understand the impact of air quality.
Okay, final question. It's a two-parter. The average person listening to this pod is an American professional living in their house or apartment. So if you were going to just advise the average listener, here's like a checklist, 1, 2, 3, obvious priorities for your internal air. This gets back to the box fan obsession. Like, should everybody be building these box fans or is it something else? Or if I'm prioritizing to maximize my impact, what are kind of the top three things? And then second part of the question is, similarly, for this average listener, if they want to get involved in advocacy in some way for this, who do they advocate to and what do they advocate, I guess?
Great questions. I was going to say, if you didn't ask me that last one, I would say that's a thing you must do as individuals. Think about the advocacy angle. As an individual, I would number one, buy a low-cost air quality monitor. You can read some reviews online. There's a couple of good technical experts that have given reviews. Buy one.
And it'll be CO2 that's measuring or several things?
Yeah, usually CO2. I have one that is a CO2 monitor, and then I have one that's both CO2 and particulate matter. I would look for one or both of those entities. CO2 is really powerful because in the United States of America, where we usually don't have that much pollution outdoors, CO2 is much more visible in terms of indoor contaminants in that way. So number one, buy a monitor and carry it around with you. Test it out in your home. Right now, I'm sitting in my office and I've closed all the windows and doors to make sure it's quiet and my CO2 is rising. And so it's good to note, like, I'm slightly less smart because of that.
I wasn't going to say anything.
Yeah. But carry it around, not just your home. Carry it around, like, give it to your kids, see what it's like in their school. Take it to your library. Take it to your subway. Subways are pretty polluted.
Yeah. Oh, geez.
So measure the air quality. Just, like, have some awareness to it. And you can look at outdoor air quality to learn about how that relates to your sensor. Number two, I would take interventions in your home to improve the air, which is putting in an air purifier to filter out particles. So these are things like what could come from cooking. These are things that could come from hosting a dinner party. If someone's sick there, those airborne contaminants. Yeah. This can also capture allergens during allergy season. Put in an air purifier. I have one in my bedroom and I have one in my common space near my kitchen. My bedroom, like having one where the place that you sleep and you spend maybe 8 hours a day, is really important. So make those interventions. And then number three, I would think about source control, which is if you have combustion sources in your home, like gas stoves or gas appliances, that combustion, you're burning a fuel and you're emitting all of these chemical compounds that come off of that. So we're not just talking about when you fry food and you see all the splatters come out of those you know, the potato and the oil frying up, but also just burning that gas continuously sometimes in homes releases these dangerous chemicals that you're often never aware of. And they're ones that we don't capture from these low-cost monitors, but they're there and can have really long-term health. So I'd say if you have the opportunity, make those changes in your home.
Electrify,
right. And like we talked already about energy recovery ventilators as really also cool ways to do it efficiently. So that's what I'd say for your home and kind of you as an individual. And then what to do about helping change the world, helping change your environment or your state or your nation or the broader community. How can you get involved and what are ways to be an advocate? Number one, I'd say become a champion of indoor air. And so that means carry on the monitor, be aware. And we've just started something that we in some ways cheekily call Air Club, which is a global movement for individuals to be a part of and come together, share resources, learn from each other. AirClub.org is the website that we've created. And this was launched during the United Nations event when so many of us together are like, wait, this is a no-brainer. We're all part of this club. So if you want to be part of that global community, number two, the Global Pledge for Healthy Indoor Air that we talked about, bring that to your organization, to your school, to your local city. It says one, I mean, it says many things, but it primarily talks about one important theme, which is clean indoor air is a fundamental human right. We should prioritize this topic. I also just want to recognize Bronwyn King was the co-organizer and co-author of that pledge, a leader in Australia, kind of coming up from workplace safety movements and the public health community. And then number three is turn to some organization in your community, whether it's your school district or whether it's the leader of, you know, the building facilities manager of your office or whether it's your local politician and ask them about this topic and what they're doing about this topic or what they're doing about the quality of the air in that building that matters to you.
Yeah, like in Seattle, we just have been in long process of updating our comprehensive plan, which is all about zoning and how many floors you can, you know, all about building stuff. I've been wondering, like, whether anyone in that process is paying attention to indoor air. It'd be some good people to bug about it. Well, this has been just perfect, just enormously illuminating. I can't thank you enough. This is super interesting, such a compliment to all the other things we talk about here, and such an obvious, as we keep saying back and forth, so obvious, such an obvious thing to pay attention to. So thank you for coming and walking us through it.
Thank you so much for having me, David.
Thank you for listening to Volts. It takes a village to make this podcast work. Shout out especially to my super producer, Kyle McDonald, who makes me and my guests sound smart every week. And it is all supported entirely by listeners like you. So if you value conversations like this, please consider joining our community of paid subscribers at volts.wtf, or leaving a nice review, or telling a friend about Volts, or all three. Thanks so much, and I'll see you next time.